And one of the people who is thinking about it, working on it, and in this case, testifying to Congress about it, is Max Steyer, president and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service. If you're a regular listener, you heard me play some highlights of this hearing, including some of Max's testimony on Monday's show. This House Oversight and Government Reform Committee hearing is available now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The second panel is the panel on which Max was testifying, and he joins me now to talk about this hearing and this issue in general. It's great to talk to you again, Max. Thanks for being on today.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'll editorialize for a moment. One of the things that every management expert tells me when they're on this show or when I'm talking to them off the air is rather than fixating on how you got to where you start where you are and you fix from there. And I got a sense that despite some really good points being made by Colin Kelly of NTEU and Andrew Biggs of AEI and James Shirk of the Heritage Foundation about kind of how the federal workforce got to where they are, your tack was somewhat different, and it dealt more with this is where we are today. We all seem to agree the GS system needs some help. Am I sensing the right kind of vibe from your testimony there?
You are indeed, and I could not have said it better. So you said it exactly right.
The idea that the GS system is not, maybe not what it could be, that seems to be universal. Do you think that there are some points, are we looking at a total do-over, or are we looking at maybe a restructuring?
Well, I think your original comment is a very powerful one, which is this is not a blank paper exercise. We have a system that's in place right now, and we have to move from where we are today to something better. And therefore, I think that it is worthy in the process of imagining what comes next that we understand what the transaction costs of getting there are. Clearly, the GS system now isn't what we need in the talent market that we have today. I mean, interestingly enough, I mean, this is a system that's 60 years old. At the time it was put in place, salary surveys weren't done because the expectation was that folks would stay with the same employer forever. And by and large, the white-collar jobs, 70% of them, were actually clerical. So the differentiation that you see in today's world didn't exist either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have seen some changes to make the system more market sensitive. You know, the FEPCA in 1990 basically introduced the concept that where you were working mattered in terms of the wages you would receive. I'm from Iowa myself. Cost of labor is quite a bit different in Iowa than it is in Washington, D.C. And FEPCA allowed for the system to be able to meaningfully account for that difference. In today's world, what we still don't have is a system that permits you to distinguish between the different occupations and the different levels within those occupations. So if you're a GS-12 computer, IT specialist or a HR professional or a lawyer, whatever, it's all the same. And that simply doesn't make sense. So we need a system that permits the differentiation around the labor market, around the special occupations that we need to fill in the federal government.
One of the things about this hearing that I took away, and the reason that I mentioned I kind of imagined you as I listened, and then it seemed a little bit as I went back and watched, like you were kind of caught in the crossfire between the think tank scholars on one side and Colleen on the other side, at least figuratively, if not literally. While they were debating each other's numbers and sources of information and so on, you were kind of in the middle going, hey, wait a minute, maybe this isn't the issue. We should be thinking about how you get to this new system, whatever it is, whatever it's shaped around. After I played those highlights on Monday, I had Howard Risher on the show who helped to do some of the studies behind FEPCA in 1990.
Right.
And we talked about how that model might be used to kind of make some of the changes that you're talking about. Do you think that's a good place to start, to go back and say this is how we did it with locality? Maybe some of these same techniques or structures would work when we're talking about job classifications.
Yeah, look, I think that is a entirely plausible approach. I think we need to explore a set of different possibilities here, and more than just the sort of substance, we need a process that really engages all the relevant stakeholders. Because the truth of the matter is, there's no such thing as a right system. You have to have a system that everyone believes in, and that's going to therefore work well because people have been part of the process in creating it. And I think that's a critical ingredient here, is to emphasize the need for the stakeholders to buy into whatever the changes are going to be. It is probably the case, however, that if you really want to fix the system, you need to do more than simply inject some market sensitivity around occupations. The classification system itself, frankly, is problematic. The idea, again, that you can, classify, make distinctions between the GS-11 versus the GS-12 and not allow for more variability is really not a long-term solution. But the truth of the matter is that incremental improvements are meaningful, and if that's what we can get, terrific. If we can do more than that, that's great as well. If I could come back to your first point, though, about the crossfire piece. My general view is that everyone at the table there, in point of fact, had some level of agreement around, as you said, the notion that there is a way to do things better. And I do believe that the tendency sometimes is to get caught up in these arguments. Are feds underpaid or overpaid? When in point of fact, no one really knows. And John O'Leary at Harvard captured it best in my mind when he said, it's the Goldilocks truth, which is that there are going to be some that are overpaid, some underpaid, and some just right.
Mm-hmm.
So the real issue is, what do we do to make the whole system better? And I'm hopeful that we can see the relevant parties move in that direction, and I didn't feel so much in the crossfire as I felt like we are in a world of hurt as a government and as a country, and we don't really have time for these kinds of debates. We need to move beyond them.
I want to come back to the data conversation later on because I think there's probably a place for it, and I think you might agree with that. I'll be interested to hear your thoughts. But as I'm talking to you, you use the word stakeholders, and that word has been used a lot in this. And I wonder if we might be able to just quickly brainstorm a little bit about kind of as comprehensive a list as we can think of who the stakeholders should be. I wrote down agency management. And we can talk some more about who specifically that should be, not names of people, but
right.
But levels of people.
Right.
OMB, OPM, Congress, and we can also talk about who in Congress should be involved in this conversation, employee unions and other employee representative groups, and maybe even academia. Is there anybody that I left out of that list that you think should be considered?
You've got a pretty comprehensive list. I think it's... again, I'd like to believe that there are nonprofit organizations like ours that have something to add to the conversation. But there are also groups like, veterans organizations, the disability community. There are other public policy preferences that are pursued in the federal employment process. And I think those stakeholders should be included as well. Because they have, again, as the word is described, they have something truly at stake in this and in these conversations. And it may also be possible when you talk about the academic side that there are other, state, governments or other, other experts from other public sector organizations that might have some value to add. But I think you've covered the core participants.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the agency management piece and the Congress piece when we come back from the break. My guest is Max Steyer. He's president of the Partnership for Public Service on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, and we're talking about advancing the discussion on transitioning or making changes potentially to the general schedule. It's In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Arming your home security system gives you peace of mind. But are you paying $30, $40, $50 or more in home monitoring fees? Switch to Ackerman Security Systems and pay just $18.95 a month, and there's no cost to switch. Why Ackerman? Ackerman has over 40 years of industry-leading experience. Ackerman monitors your home from its UL and CSAA 5 Diamond Certified Monitoring Center. Ackerman was recently recognized as the National Dealer of the Year from over 30,000 companies. Get the most qualified professionals monitoring your home for just $18.95 per month. And Ackerman offers the latest technology, including wireless monitoring. Over 180,000 people enjoy peace of mind with Ackerman. Federal employees call today and get 4 months of basic monitoring free when you switch or start service. Call 888-999-1070, 888-999-1070, or visit AckermanSecurity.com.
What is the Federal Aviation Administration's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen? How will NextGen improve the national airspace system? What is FAA doing to continue to be a global leader in aviation? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and more with Randy Babbitt, Administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration. That's next week on the Business of Government Hour, produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government.
Data center managers, IT professionals, technology officers, what if you could reduce the time to deploy new servers from days or weeks to minutes? Would you benefit if more of your production applications could be virtualized? The Cisco Unified Computing Solution, or UCS, is designed for compatibility, energy efficiency, large memory footprints, and manageability. GovConnection has the technical resources and expertise to help you with your virtualization planning and implementation. Call GovConnection, a Cisco Gold Certified and UCS Authorized Partner, to learn more at 800-800-0019 or visit GovConnection. Connection.com.
Hey there, I'm Christopher Dorabeck. Here's what we're working on for the Dorabeck Insider this afternoon. Recovery.gov, the website, set the standard for transparency and openness, tracking $800 billion in stimulus spending. Well, the Recovery Board's annual report, it's just out. We'll get the board's self-assessment. And the U.S. Geological Survey, they increased the magnitude of that earthquake in Japan, 9.0. We'll talk to them about how that happens this afternoon. 3 to 7 on the Dorabeck Insider. It's right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Max Dyer, the president of the Partnership for Public Service, my guest, talking about the situation with the general schedule in wake of testimony that Max gave to the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee last week. You heard it on Monday on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We talked before the break about the stakeholders that would be at the table at a discussion of how the federal workforce structure would look moving forward, Max. And specifically, when it comes to the agencies, the management at the agencies, how far down should that go? Does it necessarily need to start from the top, the people who are involved in this discussion about the general schedule? What are your thoughts about who at the individual agencies should be involved in this conversation?
Look, I think one of the interesting challenges for government is that the leadership group has a very short time horizon and therefore is not frequently literally looking out for the long-term interests of the organizations that they're running. And I say this as a preview, I think that's actually one of the two key root causes of management dysfunction in government. But I think when you say agency management, I think the challenge is, I think you have to include both political and career leadership in the conversation. And you need to move beyond just the HR function. There's obviously special knowledge that the HR function has. But at the end of the day, what we really need to see in government more generally is programmatic leadership actually owning talent. So it really ought to be the agency head who sees that as part of their responsibility making sure the organization has the long-term talent it needs to succeed, and that's really what this is about, the pay conversation. In the overall conversation, I think you need some of the HR specialists, but you really need, people who are at the top of the house of one or more agencies who are participating, and similarly, as you already identified, I think OMB has to be involved as of course OPM does.
You say a couple of things there that I think are really interesting, Max. One of them is that it's not just the HR people should be there, and I'll get into the career versus political in a moment, too. But I think you're exactly right. The idea that only HR people would be sitting there saying, all right, I'm going to speak for our IT shop, or I'm going to speak for our financial management shop. Even though I don't work with the financial managers at the agency on a regular basis, I'm kind of familiar with what they do, where if you have the CFO at the table in on this conversation, he can say, well, our financial management people do X, Y, and Z, and it's comparable in the private sector to A, B, and C. That seems to me to be almost, that's necessary, it strikes me.
Absolutely. And again, I think this is a broader problem, but by and large, talent people issues are viewed as an HR responsibility rather than a leadership responsibility. And we have to remember what the end objective here. The end objective should be getting the right talent at the most cost-effective price for government to achieve what we need out of government. And if that's the objective, the owners of that objective really are the ultimate leaders in government. And so they have to be engaged and involved in the process of determining what kind of system is going to get them the right talent. And if you don't have them involved, then you're unlikely at the end of the day to achieve that end objective.
All right. I don't mean to cast aspersions on my political appointee friends. As they say at dinner parties, some of my best friends are political appointees.
There you go.
But it strikes me that if we all agree the average political appointee is on the job for 18 months to 2 years, that means if this meeting or this thought process convenes in the time frame in which you're encouraging it, which is about 20 minutes ago, that means that folks that are participating that are politicals have either been on the job a short period of time and won't be here when this process is probably done, or haven't been there at least long enough to get a frame of reference into how these things work. So what's the role of the career leadership at the agencies to be able to participate in this as well?
Yeah, and again, it's part of the nature of government and its complication, which is that there is no single leadership group that can adequately represent the interests of the government agency. And so you do need both the political and the career participation. And for the reasons that you just stated, you need people who have a much greater depth of knowledge about what the implications are, what the real needs are. And that's something that I think, as you say, doesn't come very frequently with the political leadership. I do want to also make one last point on this, which is that, this is not only an issue about designing a system around pay. This is actually really connected to the question about understanding what good performance is and what quality is in the employees that we're bringing into government. Because at the end of the day, this is there's two things that the two sides of the equation. One is what do we need to be paying, but for what? And we need to have a real appreciation for both what talent we need in government, but what actually distinguishes the talent to make it the best talent for the jobs that we need filled. And right now in government, as much as we need to change the pay system and maybe the GS classification system, we also need to do some real work on understanding what real performance is and what quality is in an employee in the workforce.
That's an interesting observation. Howard Richer told me the same thing on Monday, and his observation too was that performance isn't an HR issue at all, and sometimes it gets stuck there, and it's really a management issue, and that's something that should be more at the C-suite and not necessarily with the CHCO.
Totally.
As we wrap up, one more thought I wanted to ask you about, and that's this data. You mentioned your view that the issue is not so much do federal employees get paid more or less, but there is, don't you think, a place for that information at some point in this process, right?
Well, the problem is that the conversation is always taking place in the context of broad generalizations. So my favorite example of why this doesn't work is that if Bill Gates walked into your studio right now, my guess is that the average wealth level of everybody there, and I don't know how many folks are there, but it could be a bunch, would be that you'd all be billionaires. And the point is that doesn't say a whole lot about what you actually own and what anyone else in the radio station owns. It says a lot about what Bill Gates owns.
Mm-hmm.
And so the arguments, in by and large, that we've seen so far are all, suffer from the same fallacy of trying to make these broad generalizations and averages, and they don't tell you what you need to know. And that's true in all kinds of ways. When we talk about whether there's an attrition problem in government, there may not be one overall on average, but if you look at new employees, if you look at mission-critical occupations, if you look at the SES, you do have a problem. So you really have to focus on the critical specifics and not on the generalization. So, you know, these number battles really leave me cold because they don't really advance the conversation. They're frequently really proxies for a, you know, political ideological war, and they're not really helpful in improving management.
And that's very similar to what Director Barry said at this hearing. He was talking, I think, about one type of doctor at VA hospitals where he's got a serious attrition problem. Either doctors or some kind of healthcare professionals, I recall.
Yes.
He's in on panel one of this House Oversight and Government Reform Committee hearing. You can watch the video for it posted right now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Another one of the witnesses, my guest, Max Steyer, president of the Partnership for Public Service. And I'm going to make sure that it's not so long till you're on the show again next time, Max.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for all your great work.